listening. A rare talk in English in Paris. <That's funny. laughs> I read something recently that when I don't know which ones, but some American astronauts, when they were in space, said that their experience was of having met God. And then some Russian astronauts, when they were in space, apparently said that their experience was that they experienced that there was no God. And that with some Americans at one point, there was a Saudi Arabian astronaut, I didn't know that, who said when he was in space, he had been in wonder at the creation of Allah's creation. And then the paragraph continued saying if there had been an Indian astronaut, he probably would have said that he encountered Krishna or something. And then he adds, actually there was an Indian with a Russian team once, but no one mentioned what he had said. And the Russian, when they accounted for what had been said, they didn't mention what he said. And this was all being said to, it ended with something like, this paragraph ended with something like, in different soil, different flowers grow. And the teacher who had written this was a Japanese teacher, was using this to, as an example of how do we go back to how we are conditioned by our whatever situation we've been raised in, whatever soil. So the Christian American astronauts would say they've met God, and the Russians raised in an atheist religion is the opium of the people society would say they met no God, whatever. That through sitting, the sitting practice, what we are aiming for is to come back to a blank page where we experience, our experience is not conditioned by whatever we are deeply conditioned by. And we often say, you know, what is your original face? What is your original face before your parents were born? What is your true face? These things like that. The true you. And what they're pointing at is this before the conditioning, before the flavors, the patterns that we've established, and the ways that we experience or choose to or not see things. And I had not really ever thought of it in those terms, and yet I would not use those words, I don't think, to talk about what we do here. At the same time, I thought it was a very telling example. And I read that, and then I had my Portuguese lesson today. And very intense. A lot of the time I have no idea what she's saying to me. I know what we're talking about, so I know more or less, but sometimes it's not really clear. Or I have the book, and so I can tell what she's referring to. But there are moments when, and I know this from when I learned French, there are moments when it's almost as if I step back from some habitual way of listening, and then I get it. Then I hear what she's saying. I hear the words. I understand the words. And I think most of the time I'm kind of on automatic, and I think we all are most of the time. I still have this experience when I go to French movies, and I mean, I've lived here forever, and I can understand, you know, most anything anyone says, unless they have a really strong accent or something. But I still, you know, it's going to a French movie and going to an English movie is not the same. I have to pay attention in a different way when it's in French. I can't just go on automatic pilot and not really think about it. I could to a certain extent, but it really demands another kind of attention. And I know that when I learned French, there was a moment when my professor at the university in France where I was had said, just leave the radio on all the time. Even if you don't understand it, just put the radio on. So whenever I was in my apartment, I had my room, I had France Inter turned on, and half the time, most of the time I had no idea what it was. I could pick out a word here and there. It was when Sadat was assassinated. And I heard Sadat, I heard the name, and I knew something dramatic had happened from what they were talking and everything. But I didn't get it, what they were saying. Sometime after that, there was a moment like this, where suddenly, I think I had stepped back from my habitual way. I had let go of my conditions of how I hear words, how I frame language, what I expect to hear, my automatic pilot, which is just used to going like this. Suddenly, when I was hearing French, it had to go like this or something. And it was as if all of that fell away, and I could understand. I heard the whole phrase on the radio, and I could suddenly follow what was being said. Of course, then I had to cultivate that and pursue it and become more proficient. And it's something like that with our sitting practice. It's as if we don't understand what is being. Or we have this idea about what is being. We have this grill through which we see being. You know, if we're a Christian, then we see God. If we're not Christian, then we see no God. If we're Muslim, we see Allah, you know, whatever, something like this. And it can be, you know, they were all seeing the same thing out there. And probably the experience was unspeakable to some extent for all of them. But then when they had to come back and say something about it, they fell back on what they knew, which of course is normal because we use language to communicate things. And in this practice, that's what we're doing, it's as if we have to, we always say let go, but it's more like just not be held in thrall to, how would you say that in French? In thrall to something? Like, be emballé par quelque chose, peut-être?
Enchaîné, quelque chose.
Non. C'est comme emballé, comme être captivé par. Être captivé par quelque chose. It's almost as if we're captivated by our usual functioning, our usual way. Because it's safe. You know, there's no risk involved in the usual way we experience things. And all of the techniques we have in the sitting that's what the aim is, to shake the tree, you know, so that it's not holding on to its usual positioning, and then something falls, you know, and some fruit falls from it. way, we talk about this as being, you know, free, a path of freedom or liberation or something. That's what the freedom is about. The freedom to just experience whatever it is. You know, be any flower, be any kind of water, any surface, any material, any emotion. And so just before I sat down, I got this rakusu yesterday from my teacher. She should have given it to me a year ago when I received, was it last year? Yeah, when I received Inca?
Yeah,
it was last year. Yeah. And she put the date on there. Yeah. It was last year. and she should have done it then, but she didn't have it. So she gave it to me a year later on my birthday. And on it, she wrote a poem, which is traditional. The teacher gives a poem to the student when they receive Inca. So it says, L'oiseau s'est envolé de la branche et, dans le ciel infini, trace sa route invisible, claire, mystérieuse, précise, unique, libre. Tu es cela. My name is Tu es cela. My Dharma name is Tu es cela. And there's something in this infinite sky, tracing your route, your path, invisible, clear, precise, mysterious, unique, free. But there's a path. The sky is infinite, the sky is empty, but there's a path. And each of us traces, makes our way in that. And the more that we deepen our practice, the more that we experience this no ground, or this, it's not even a background, it's this no ground, the more our path becomes precisely ours, precisely unique and free. It sounds like a contradiction in terms. It's not. It's true. It's true. That's my experience, let's say. And I mean, it touches me that my teacher recognizes that, and that's what she says. You know, that's what she writes. That's what she trained me to do. That's what she taught me to be. That's what she transmitted to me, as it were. And that's what I am doing here too. If I stray from that, I've lost my way. Because that is my way. There is, for me, there is nothing, no other way than that.
Can you say again how did you describe that way earlier? What was that part that was contradictory?
It seems contradictory that first I'm saying, let go of your conditioning, let go of your usual way of being, thinking, seeing. Take a step back to this blank page, you know, this neutral ground or something, original face. Which seems like then I'm no one. I mean, if I don't have everything that I'm conditioned by, my usual habits and everything, I'm nobody. And well, by doing that, then we make our way, our very own precise, invisible, clear, invisible but clear, mysterious but precise, unique, free way in this vast empty sky. She doesn't say empty, but she says dans le ciel infini. And so it says, l'oiseau s'est envolé de la branche. So the bird leaves the branch. I mean, this is like symbolic talk of, so I left her branch, studying with my teacher, whatever, and I flew off on my own. It's kind of symbolic way of looking at it. But the same thing applies for all of us in what are the branch that we are settled upon, however it manifests. But this is a practice of every moment. This is not like, you know, this is not saying I've accomplished this and it's forever and ever. The reason that I can receive this is because, to some degree, I know that. And that's my practice, is this moment to moment, leaving the branch, flying into the empty sky, making my way free, invisible, clear, precise, unique. Right? But it's every moment. And if I just talk about me once more, the reason, if there's a reason why I'm doing this, why I'm sitting here with you, is because of that. Because I know that, for me and for others who I've seen, and for my teacher, there is a flying away from the branch into the empty sky, into the infinite sky, and a path that we trace, each of us. I know that. And I see that, because all of us do it, more or less. You know, we all have our original ways of doing things. Experiencing things, or when I, you know, that's why I say when I work with people on koans, no two people pass a koan the same way. It's just, it's impossible. It's impossible. And in order for me to work with someone on koan, with people on koans, or even just to talk to them, just to meet them in our meeting when we talk about practice or whatever they bring to me, I have to be in that infinite empty sky and able to be with whatever arises and follow their unique, clear, invisible, mysterious path. If I don't, then we may as well just be, you know, sitting in a cafe and having a drink. No. You know, I'm reminded of the story I told about on the other night when there was someone who came, was here for the first time, and came in, was the last person to come in for the interview, and just kept talking and talking and talking. And everyone finished here and left, and I was still in there with him, and he was just talking. And in a way, I would say I was in that empty sky, an infinite sky, just with him on his path. At some point, I had to introduce something else and say, okay, this is it. It's over. We have to go. That's what I have to do, too. Because I have a different sense of that path in the infinite sky than he does. And so I have to recognize when, okay, this is enough. Of course, he probably could have sat there for 2 hours, I don't know, and talked away, I don't know. But he seemed perfectly happy to keep talking. But I could sense that it was enough. It's not a judgment that it was too much. It's just because I'm accompanying, and I'm in this place, and I know the ground better than him, because I've been there and I'm familiar with it, I can feel. And I'm open to what's happening and I can feel in a different way. Now, if I went into space with the astronauts, I don't know what I would say. I have no idea. If I would say, seeing the face of God. I think it's probably a life-changing experience, though, from what I've heard, when you no longer are on your familiar ground, the earth, and you're out there. And I've been wondering lately about the guys, these guys who are doing this, you know, around the world sailing thing, the Vendée Globe, who are now like, you know, Antarctica, right?
They're between Australia and South Africa.
Yeah.
For the first ones.
And, like, probably in some of the farthest distance you can possibly be from land, from habitated land, you know, alone on a boat. I mean, it's really extreme. And I wonder, you know, you don't really hear about it, but they must have some sense of something other than the rest of us when you're out there on that boat. Have you ever read anything that they've said or any?
Oh, yeah.
Any kind of deep, you know, experience they have of?
Well, the famous one is Noitessier, who, the first one, and he, on his way back, he was going up, and he thought, yeah, he was leading the race. He just thought, oh, I'm just going to continue. So he continued. He never came back.
He never came back.
He went to Tahiti. He was on his way back. He was leading the race, and then he just couldn't. He was like, this is perfect.
Oh,
this is a very good story.
Interesting.
And there's also one guy whose boat is, his project is Commun Seul Homme. And it's like a very spiritual journey for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's the whole name of the project, Commun Seul Homme. It's like, we're one body.
What's his name?
Forgot which one is it? Bédion, maybe. I forgot which one. Yeah. So he's really into like a introspective and spiritual journey.
I'm sure that there's something there. Yeah. It's like really subtle.
Several of them, but especially this one. Not Armel Leclerc. They're really like competitors, but.
Sportsmen.
Yeah.
Okay. But even so, I would bet that they have something happens.
But
to
yeah,
them
you can't there. You can't be that long for like 80 days by yourself.
In extreme situations. Yeah. So we're not, you know, we're doing the around the world solitaire on our cushions. But, you know, our week this week of being on retreat in the middle of our life is kind of the same idea, you know, or that's when I set it up, I have that intention of trying to shake us free from our usual way of functioning. Even though we're doing the same stuff that we do all the time, if even once during the week someone had a moment where something that they do all the time was different this week, even if it was just, you know, I don't know, locking up your bike or sitting in the metro or, I don't know, something, you know, whatever it was, putting the kids to sleep. Just if there was one moment that it was not like it always is, then we win. Of course, we never lose, but...
What do we win?
What?
What do we win?
That's right. I'm just using these terms of winning and losing because I'm thinking of these guys, you know. It's not a question of winning and losing at all. But
it's funny because in the race, they're not making a lot of money if they win.
Mm-mm.
I mean, the price is really little compared to the...
Investment,
and it's like 80 days, and I think they win like 150 euros, 150,000 euros. I mean, if you compare that to Roland Garros or to any other sport, it's even like smaller than the boat, from the costs of the boat, which is,
Well, and from what I understand, there's only like a few of them who really have a chance of winning it.
Right.
They're most they're of them even, are kind of just
right. They're not even going to win. They're just going to
do it.
Do it, and just in a more like secure environment than what you would do usually, because there's a it's a race, so there's a whole organization.
So no, it's not about winning or losing, but as we always learn when we were children, it's not about winning or losing, it's about how you play the game. Do they say that in France? But
well, we kind of say l'essentiel c'est de participer. I mean, what you're saying about the astronauts, I can't stop thinking that even in that extreme, unusual experience, they still express that in their habitual setup of thinking. So I wonder if, like, you might think that maybe it would change radically the way they would look at things, but in fact they still go back to their own conditioning. So it's like, I don't even know if they, you know, you were suggesting that maybe they were like coming back because you can't do otherwise, and because, but it's even then they just express an habitual way of thinking. It's like they haven't, it hasn't killed that conditioning. That experience.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It could be that. I would like to think that it's just because that's the only terminology they have in which to express it. You know, it's this awesome thing. And so that's the only way they can express it or something. I don't know. But possibly, I don't know. I think one of them, one of the Americans, I forget which one it was, actually came, you know, became a deeply spiritual person after his space travel. And I think he was maybe the one who was... He wasn't... There were three astronauts for one of the moon landings... Maybe the first moon landing. There were three, and he was the one who stayed in the ship, and two others went onto the moon's surface, and he was the one who stayed in the ship alone and orbited the moon. And there was at a point where he was on the dark side of the moon and couldn't even see the Earth, you know, alone in his ship. And I think that was probably really intense. And I think he's the one, I can't remember his name, Michael something, he became like this really spiritual guy. And not like, you know, born-again Christian, but very deeply spiritual. That must have been really intense, though, yeah.
That's worse than Vendée Globe.
I don't know. Yeah. You're alone in this tiny little spacecraft and orbiting the moon, and you go behind the moon and you can't even see the Earth anymore. I mean, at the same time, the two guys on the moon, that must have been pretty intense too. Huh? The ship goes away, you land there, and oh my god. But, you know, it's the same. We can have those experiences sitting on our cushions. Really? Now, you know, because, okay, where do we draw the line? You know, where do we draw the line of extreme? From my own personal experience, you know, I was this single mother with a totally normal job and live in the high life in Paris. And I didn't do anything special. I just kept living that life. Went and lived with my partner in a Zen center, of course, yes. I didn't live in my apartment in the Marais anymore. And had a second child. Kept my job. Nothing special was required. to make this, trace this path in the infinite sky. However, it does take discipline and desire and rigor. You know, it's something about not compromising on the rigor. And I'm still very rigorous about it. People, you can look and say, okay, I'm kind of like a loose teacher, anything goes, you know, it's not very formal and everything, but it's very rigorous what is proposed. What I'm proposing is very rigorous. Because it's not about the form, it's not how it looks. So we don't need, extreme experiences can be helpful. Bernie Glassman likes to put people in extreme circumstances to open their hearts and their minds. And there is something to that. But you don't have to do that. There is no one thing you have to, place you have to go or thing you have to do, except be here now and look. If you don't look, you won't see. You know, it's the old thing, seek and you shall find. It's true. And it's true, actually. You know, there are probably some people in extreme circumstances. Some of these sailors in the Vendée Globe, you know, maybe they really don't. C'est un peu étanche. Maybe they don't really. You know, they experience something, I'm sure, in that, in the rigor of it. But maybe it's more like adrenaline. You know, competitive, a challenge of survival, and because it really is intense, huh? Someone told me that there was a guy, was it last year or something, who cut his tongue?
No, every 4 years, but it wasn't the past edition, but it was even before. Yeah, he had to sew his tongue.
He had to sew his tongue up himself. Whoa.
They're more or less strange. But what is very interesting is they all have unexpected events that they have to deal with. Mm. And they... completely unknown. Mm. I mean, it's like they can't prepare themselves really for what's going to happen.
Doesn't that sound like our practice? I mean, they're as prepared as they can be, I'm sure.
Right, the boats are prepared and all that, but then they hit some things and
the weather changes.
They have to do things, and then some. There's one guy right now who doesn't have any. His electronics don't work the way it should work, so he doesn't receive any weather forecasts. So he has to, and he can't communicate with his teams really. So it's just
wow. Yeah.
But the thing with the extreme experiences, it also thinking about Bernie and the various practices. From the outside, also, it for some people it might feel more exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It looks from the outside more exciting, and so there's a
stimulation.
Yeah, stimulation, and and maybe also for some people also it's like to crush the shell, our conditioning, kind of need to push harder also with them, and that's a technique.
Yeah, and it's useful. Mm. It can be.
I remember when I was during the Auschwitz retreat, I spent so many hours in the beginning, felt I couldn't really connect to that experience. I mean, to that, it was so intense what I was seeing, but at the same time I was putting it into very rational boxes. It was like, it was trying to understand the functioning of it. and so, but it was, I think it really helped me to, because it was so intense, to, at some point I had to let go of, it was, I could not understand it. I had to drop that idea that I could understand it.
Mm.
But it had to go, it had to be so unbearable to the point that I had to bear witness to that and let go of all the condition. And that was very interesting, that moment.
Yeah, and that's what happens in extreme situations. Well, and that's why we had, you know, we set up sessions and, you know, with little sleep, no distractions. You know, there are, I've been in retreats where there was no coffee or tea, you know, so there was no caffeine, there was no sugar, there was really no talking. It was in a house, and even the books were covered up with sheets, you know, so you couldn't even look at the bookshelves. Yeah, you've been in that kind of thing too. And it's intense, you know, and it's just like full on sitting. Roshi told me that last year, at this next week, she has a retreat for 5 days, I think. And last year at that time, the same retreat, she does one every year at this time. She didn't announce it, but she did no Dharma talks. There were no interviews. The only thing there was at the end of the week, a circle. Otherwise, it was just sitting for 5 days, which is very unusual in her sangha. It would be like in our sangha. We always have talks and interviews and things. She said it was really, really powerful. For everybody. For her, it was great because she didn't have to do anything. She could just sit there all day long and not have to think about a talk or talking to people or anything, you know. And so it was really powerful. And when I heard that, I said, oh, are you doing that next week? Because João is coming from Portugal. And he really wanted, he's coming especially to do that retreat. And I thought, oh, the poor guy, you know, because I'm sure he would like to have an interview with her. He would like to hear the talks, you know, and everything. And she said, no, I decided not to do it this year. So, João will get to hear the talks and the interviews and things. But it's extreme. I mean, that's the idea of setting up retreats like this. Your resistances break down and you don't have sleep, you don't have a lot of food. You're not doing your usual thing. You know, sometimes, you know, there's retreats where you have to put your phone, you have to give your phone at the beginning of the week, or weekend, or whatever it is. You're not supposed to read. It's very powerful. Very powerful. And for the moment, I haven't had the opportunity to do that. It is great. It's really great. Yeah. For the moment, I haven't had the opportunity to do that, but it's not impossible. But we will do that. But can we be flexible and there's maybe more individual effort necessary if we don't have such a rigid structure. Because then you have to discipline yourself and say, okay, well, I'm not gonna use my phone during these 3 days, or I'm not gonna read during the breaks, or I'm not gonna talk. There are people, you know, believe it or not, there are people who go to our retreats and don't talk throughout the whole week. There are people who do it. Doesn't seem possible, but it is. Or roommates, you know, there were a couple years ago when someone, there were two women who had come together, two Belgians, who had come together and were sharing a room, and they said, at the beginning of the week, they said, so we're going to keep silence in our room, and they did it. For the whole week, they didn't talk to each other in their rooms. I don't know usually if people talk to each other in their rooms, but... Uh, So maybe I'll have to try storing something more rigorous at some point. But already, you know, this week with the Heart of Life, even if, you know, I don't know how many people actually did any sitting or not, and I'm not checking obviously, but just the fact that that's why I want people to sign up for it. Because otherwise it's kind of like, oh yeah, I'll do it, or not. And even if you sign up for it and you don't really, you know, there's some people who didn't post anything on the blog the whole week. It's okay. It's not, there's no requirement of any of it. But just the simple fact of signing up for it changes something. And surprisingly, there were some people who, I think there were two people, who posted on the blog who didn't sign up. So I added them to the list and sent them the sign-up email. But it's a work in progress. It's ongoing, every moment. And the more we do it, then, you know, can we accept if, like this, you know, it's invisible? Can we accept that we're not leaving a mark? That we're not leaving a trace? That we have our way, but it's not leaving a trace. That's why we always say, when you leave, clean up and don't leave a trace. No sign of you even having been there. That's true freedom, actually, when we can even not worry about leaving a trace. Or checking to see what our mark is, you know. Saying, well, so what kind of shadow am I leaving, you know? What does my signature look like? There's this thing in France, even more so than, I don't remember it in the U.S., but in France, my son, when he was like in college or something, it was like, I have to find a signature. You know, people like have to have their distinctive way of signing their name. I don't remember it. So does that sound familiar to you in
yes,
France?
Yeah.
And where did that come from?
Well, because we need to sign. No, we need to sign our IDs at some point and passports. So.
Well, yeah, but I mean.
I mean, I remember that I did that when...
Like trying to find
occasion.
Your signature?
Yeah, trying to, you know, do like what my dad was like doing this kind of thing, and my mom was, he would put his name on between the lines, he would do like... And then he would... So I started doing that too.
What is my signature? And so can we not even worry about what our signature is? Just trust. Of course, the reality is you have to have it on a passport, you have to sign a check, you got to do it. So can we do both? Have your distinctive signature? My signature is very distinctive. I know that. And it's an expression of who I am, like all of us. And I know that. But at the same time, not leaving a trace. Okay, how's that for the day? Okay, good. Thank you. You didn't have to leave? You're in the time. Okay. Perfect timing. Okay. Thank you.